Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. We want to welcome you all wherever, however, and whenever you are listening to the show. We want to thank you so much. I am your host, John Robb. We have an outstanding show today for you, 90 minutes. Three authors. We're going to kick it off with author Don Mann and his SEAL Team 6 series, followed by MJ Rose and the Collector of Dying Breath. And, of course, MJ was the 2013 Crimson Scribe Award winner with her last book, The Seduction. And then Mike Bond is going to be on and talking about his series and his book, Saving Paradise. So we got a lot of action for you. So sit back, relax, enjoy, because here we go. 90 minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. You belong.
Suspense Radio. You can check out suspensemagazine.com for a lot more information. A lot of exciting news going to be coming up here shortly in the next couple months. By the end of the year, you never know what you might see out of us, and that's what makes it fun. So we're going to jump right in here to our first guest. Again, he is author Don Mann. His series is called Team 6. He has four books out in the series. The latest is called Hunt the Jackal. We are pleased to be able to speak with Don. First time to be able to have him on the show about this series because, of course, SEAL Team 6 is one that made a lot of news, of course, with the Osama bin Laden capture and kill a couple years ago, and now they're starting to come more to the forefront. So, Don, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Oh, fine, thanks, John, and thanks for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure being able to talk to you. I love the series. I love being able to get involved with something that is so real, of course, SEAL Team 6. And everything that, you know, they came to the forefront, of course, like I said, with the Osama bin Laden kill and everything else that they've done. But they've always so secretive, which, of course, is what makes them, you know, that's one of their strengths, of course. So Hunt the Jackal is the latest in the book. Give us a little bit about, you know, the book, the series, kind of the behind-the-scenes action with, you know, with SEAL Team 6 series that you have here.
All righty, John. Well, Hunt the Jackal is the fourth in the series, and pretty much I retired from SEAL Team 6 and became very, very close with quite a few of the guys there. Some have been killed, some are still living, but what I wanted to do with these Hunt series, SEAL Team 6 books, is I wanted to create characters based on SEALs that I, you know, worked with and loved and being with. And I wanted to base the stories based on those SEALs. I wanted to also base it on real-world operations and missions without anything that's classified, keeping that out of the books, but anything that's been declassified or that is happening in today's world. So the stories are based on SEALs. The missions are based on declassified missions or missions that could possibly happen. And then also there's an adventure theme to the stories. Most of these guys did quite a few long adventures with me, either climbing mountains or crossing deserts or going through jungles, you know, for recreation and sport. It's been a real pleasure working with my co-author on these. He's got so much talent in doing the research, because when a reader picks up one of these books, they're actually you're actually feeling what is going on in that country. The books take place all over the world, in the jungles, in the mountains, in the deserts. The villains, the terrorists, the bad guys in the books are based on actual guys we have captured, we have killed, or we have gone after, and they're based on real-life people without giving away any secrets. So the books are pretty close to real, and at the same time, it's all unclassified information. There's some kidnappings. There's some things that we don't really hear about in the news that I've written about. You know, a lot of this, I was in Norway once with the King of Norway's best friend, and he was on a mission. The mission was twofold. One was the spare parts program, which is a very rude, sad way to talk about organ harvesting when they were kidnapping kids. And they called it a spare parts program, where these rich, rich, rich people from around the world would take a 7 or 8 year old boy or girl who's been kidnapped, and they'd keep them in a farm type atmosphere. And if somebody needed a liver or a kidney from that child, they had it right there. It's organ harvesting, or spare parts program, it's known. So being around these type missions and these type operations, I took the characters and put them into the book. The other mission, you know, that we don't hear about so much is, you know, the kidnapping of the women that end up in harems and places like that. And so some of these stories are based on going after the real lifelike characters who've kidnapped these women and tell them for terrible reasons. And then, of course, there's the go get the Abu Zubaydahs and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the real world terrorist. And using SEAL tactics and techniques, standard operating procedures, divulging a little bit that's not classified, and how we go in and get these guys. So there's a lot to the books. There's a lot to it than just a shoot 'em up story. There's also, I also try to talk quite a bit about the hardships many SEALs, most SEALs, most people in the special operations community go through just because of their careers. So many people divorced numerous times.
Right.
The guys are gone away from home 300 plus days a year. The kids are being raised by the mothers alone, and the kids really don't get to know the fathers that well. And when the fathers come home, they get recalled to go right back to work, and say, where are you going? I can't tell you. And when are you going to come back? I don't know. And you come back, and people are injured, and people are missing. And so there's so much to tell without giving away secrets, and that was the point of these books.
Yeah, that's the sad side, of course, that the public just doesn't realize. I mean, they see the heroism side with the missions and the things that they accomplish, but that is such a small part in the daily lives that these soldiers have to endure. Such mental preparation and mental focus and mental toughness they have to have. How are you able to kind of relay that in a way so when the reader sees that, they kind of have the understanding of the emotional part that goes along with it, more than just the action and adventure part that these guys have to go through?
Well, you know, so a guy who goes through training, and the SEAL training we call a BUDS, basic underwater demolition SEAL training, he'll start out there with a lot of ambition, a lot of zest, and a lot of, like, no matter what it takes, I'm going to get through this training. I know it's going to be the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And he'll start out with a couple of hundred people, and if he finishes, there might be 18 or so people left. But just for him, just to get through that initial phase of training, what we call BUDS, he really has to give 100% of himself. Now, these guys, so many of them, are very hardworking, honest, family, Christian-like type people, where family is first. But it's a little bit conflicting, because in one sense, we'll say these type of guys where family is first, where they love their wives, they love their children. But in another sense, they choose a life where they spend very, very, very little time, because because what the job requires with the wife and children. So there is a huge conflict in there. They come home and they just, all they want to do every night, just think about the wife and wanting to be with the family. On the other hand, we choose to be away and we choose to go in harm's way. And there's an understanding that's not always clear to someone outside the community on why this happens. And maybe if you speak to 50 guys, it might be 50 different answers, but the bottom line is they love what they do. They love the families, but for some reason we choose to put the job first in many times, and because it requires that we do. It requires that we're not distracted by details. I hope little Johnny's going to do okay in school today. I hope Beth gets her braces off this, next week, because when you're overseas and you're working and you are in harm's way, you can't have these thoughts or these distractions. Or I wonder how my wife is doing. She's been without me now for 4 months. I wonder what's going on at home. None of these are even. You can't have distractions while you're going out there in harm's way. So I'm trying to get that message in every one of these novels as well, and based on real-world experiences from not only myself, but fellow teammates and just struggles we've all gone through.
Right. I mean, there's one show out that I know called, and I don't think it's out anymore, called The Unit, that I think tried to get involved with that emotional part of, like, the wives at home and then how the soldiers try to balance that. And, of course, one of the things they always said is that a distracted soldier is a dead soldier. And I hear that, of course, a lot in that show. And I guess from what you're saying, that is really kind of a true statement.
Yeah, I believe it is, John. I believe that is a true statement. And you know, the other thing is when you try to make a novel or a fiction story, if you're trying to make it realistic, what you have to do is you have to include the flaws in the system and the flaws in the human character and the flaws in the SEALs, because none of it's perfect at all. And so people do make mistakes and do mistakenly make mistakes in training and in missions and operations that have unintended consequences. You know, we call it, you know, sometimes blue on blue. When you come in one room, shooting up a room, and then the other part of the team's coming in the other side of the building, and a round goes through the walls, and you happen to hit one of your own teammates. I mean, it's devastating. It's absolutely dreadful when something like that happens. But it happens.
Right.
And it's a dangerous, dangerous job. And if that happens to you and you've just mistakenly wounded or worse, you know, one of your best friends who you've lived and fought with and for years and years and years, how do you deal with that? And so there's a lot of it that doesn't get talked about in the media or in other stories that I've seen. So we're trying our best to make it so the reader gets a real good feel for what a SEAL life is like at home, in training, during his leave or time off, and of course on the job overseas, all over the world. Now with SEAL Team 6, it's a worldwide deployment. You are responsible for events around the world, where the West Coast teams, the West Coast SEAL teams are responsible for the west side of the world, and the East Coast SEAL teams the east side of the world. But when you're talking SEAL Team 6, that's a worldwide responsibility you have. So when you get recalled, you're on that plane and you're off, and it could be anywhere in the world you're going to, in a few hours after the recall, you have to be on that plane, and you're going somewhere to handle something that has to do with sea, air, or land, SEAL. And so the missions are just countless. You might be going through the jungles, you might be going through a desert, you might have a mountain scenario, mountain terrain you're going to have to deal with. You could be going after a hijacked ship, or going out to sea, or going out to doing river operations in the jungle, Central South America. So when you get recalled, the variety of missions that you could possibly be shot out on at any time, it's endless. So also in these books, I'm trying to cover what the different missions are like when you're operating the jungles or the desert or the Arctic or in urban terrain or in the Islamic world and the criminal world, not just, you know, not our enemies, but just the criminal. We face that time to time, too.
Yeah, I mean, just amazing stuff. And I just want to remind everybody that we are speaking here with author Don Mann. Go to U.S. Frogman with two N's, so M-A-N-N, USFrogman.com to find out a lot more information, of course, with the books. And let's talk here now about Thomas Crocker. He's your main guy. I mean, he's the main guy. He's, you know, it's the Thomas Crocker kind of series, I guess, underneath the SEAL Team 6. So who is Thomas Crocker? Why was he the one when you decided, you know what, I want to start putting my life and stuff into these stories, that you decided that Thomas would be the one that would kind of spearhead it for you?
Well, you know, I was getting ready to teach a scuba course to some people going overseas on a mission. And while I was waiting for them to gear up, I started thinking of the movie, Forrest Gump, on how there's a fictional character who went through about 20 years of real life. We saw Johnson, Watergate, Nixon, AIDS, his girlfriend died of AIDS, Jenny, they called it the virus then, the Vietnam War, the ping pong. We saw this fictional character go through 20 years of life, and it gave us a good 20-year history lesson. Well, when I was thinking about that, I was thinking, you know, wouldn't it be a great idea to take a SEAL or maybe a CIA operator, even a Delta Force guy or something, make him a fictional character, which I did, Thomas Crocker, and take him through a history lesson without divulging classified information. So I came up with Thomas Crocker. Now, I'm using Thomas Crocker as the leader of the team. He was a warrant officer. He was a warrant officer at SEAL Team 6. And it's loosely based on me, but I say loosely. So we created Thomas after my character. Thomas Crocker was created after me, I should say. And then the other people on our team, we have a demo expert, a demolition expert. We have a weapons expert, communications expert, and we have a medical expert. And we have this small team, just like we do in the teams, and we get recalled, and we deploy together. And we know each other like, you know, we're brothers. And we get hurt together, and we get sick together, and we, occasionally worse things happen. And so Thomas Crocker is the head. He's the lead character of the four novels, and his teammates and Thomas deploy and work together through all four novels. So it's the same characters in all the books.
Right, and that's one of the things that, you know, the consistency, being able to get to know these guys in the books, like I said, outside of the adventures that you put them in, is, you kind of get goosebumps just listening to you talk about, you know, the things that everybody has to do. And like I said, the things that we don't get to see as regular Americans, you know, you just kind of hear about a little bit on CNN and this and that. But getting in with your books and reading them, it's a lot more on the ground. It's a lot more in depth. And was that one of your goals when you were writing, that you kind of wanted the reader to understand that it is a lot more than, like I said, than just the CNN news stories that you were to hear?
It is. It's not tainted or leaning left or leaning right like a lot of the news shows have you. This is the truth. This is how our warriors live in overseas. This is technically accurate. The weapons, the explosions, the jumping, the operations, anything that's not classified that's in there is technically sound and it's correct. For the military historian or the military buff, they'll learn a lot. For those who aren't military historians or buffs or anything like that, it's just be interesting reading, and it'll all make sense because it's the truth. As far as the missions go, people who really are up on what's going on in the world, the evil, what's going on as far as terrorism and crimes and the evil that we face as SEAL warriors, when you go overseas, when you read these books, it might not be the exact name or the exact city or location or village, but you say, you know, I know what this is about. I know exactly what this is about, and this parallels. And the other thing, the reason I wanted to make it fiction is I wrote a book called Inside SEAL Team 6, and that was my bio, and I didn't want to write that book because when I retired from the team, I was asked numerous times if I'd write a book on the team. I trained a lot of the guys who were on the raid, on the Bin Laden raid, And I refused to. I said, no, you can't give secrets away about the team. No way. No way. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. So finally, I was convinced, well, as long as I just give my bio and unclassified information, we came up with that. But that was an accurate nonfiction. It's a lot more fun writing these fiction hunt series books because I could be a lot more creative. And without divulging information, be a lot more creative and still allow the reader to see and feel what is happening to our guys, what is happening on these missions, and what's happening around the world. A lot of it that's not covered on the news.
And again, I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author Don Mann. Go to usfrogman.com. That's 2 N's, M-A-N-N. Now, the books are SEAL Team 6, starting back here with Hunt the Wolf, and going forward now to the newest one, Hunt the Jackal, Hunt the Falcon, and Hunt the Scorpion in between. So 4 books out in the series. I recommend people getting all 4 to reading all these. Now, the one thing that you do talk about is you talk about and classified, declassified information. Now, for, you know, people understand maybe, you know, they understand the terminology. But I think the one thing that you don't understand is what deems something when they say, okay, we're going to declassify that. What would be the purpose for the government to go ahead and do something like that and then make it available? I guess that's the one thing that I always wondered. Like, all of a sudden they say, okay, we're going to release this, or we're going to release this. How does that kind of process work?
Well, you know, so, for instance, when I wrote Inside SEAL Team 6, I sent it to the Publication Review Board. I sent it to SEAL Team. I sent it to SEAL Team 6 and the U.S. Government Publication Review Board. And I only was I was careful not to put anything classified in there, but I told the publishers the only way I would agree to have this published is if all 3 entities approved it. And they did. But what they also did, some of the people in the Publication Review Board felt something was on the edge, so they redacted it. And if you see that book in the back, you see a lot of redactions, and we left the redactions in where the review board blacked it out. And what they have is they have a number of people who sit around a room with manuals, and the manuals show what's classified and what's declassified, and if anything in a book or a resume or anything comes across as possibly being on the line, they redact it from that book or the resume. So what they might do is, for instance, Benghazi right now. Benghazi, there's a lot of things
big
right now that's classified. Politicians are trying to make some of the items unclassified, so the public can know what really happened when our 4 Americans were killed that night. It's a political move there because they're trying to, you know, they're trying to protect one party from having some questions to answer. And but right now there's been quite a few missions that have been declassified, mainly because with them becoming declassified and available to open source information and open source news, it does not put our troops or Americans in harm's way. Now, some missions, for instance, if somebody wrote about taking out bin Laden and they talked about some critical TTPs, the tactics, techniques, or procedures that only SEAL Team 6 had, and because they had this, they can get into a building or they can breach a wall down or they can get this intel, but only SEAL Team 6 had it. If somebody released that information and the enemy got a hold of it, then they can use that against us and it could put our guys in harm's way. And so the classifications are either to save or protect our troops or Americans, or also there might be missions still ongoing and operations ongoing in that part of the world or having to do with people involved in that mission or operation. And so they don't want to talk about it or release the information. They're very, very conservative, and they'll if there's any question as to something being declassified or not, they will not declassify it. And the United States does a really good job at that. On the other hand, the media does a very good job at what they do, which actually hurts the military and hurts the government in a lot of ways because they'll get onto a story that we don't really want spoken of. They'll get onto a story, and they'll do what they're so good at and find out more facts and features of the story. And for the military or the government, it might be something we don't want released, but if the media gets a hold of it, then that's happened so often too, where they'll go out and release it, and it hurts our troops and it hurts our government. And it's vague, it's gray. You know, we have freedom of speech, freedom of press. You know, we're our American people, our taxpayers should know what, for the most part, our troops are doing. But then there's the side where, my God, don't put that out. If you put that out, how are we going to come around that side of the beach? How are we going to get on the beach if you're going to put the news out there? We'll come to the beach. And so those things have hurt the military and the government numerous times. And it's almost like the media and the enemy, the media almost becomes the enemy toward the military and the government when those things happen. Unfortunately.
I'll tell you what, Don, I mean, it's been fascinating talking with you. I mean, I could go on for hours just listening because these are, the stories that you have and the stories that you've been able to put now into your SEAL Team 6 series are definitely something that everyone would find interesting and something that people should just clamor over and get to. So I want to thank you so much for coming on just to sharing just a little snippet of the stuff that you've been able to do, and can't wait to see what's coming on in the future, and would love to have you back on and talk further.
Well, thank you very much, John. I'd love to be back on the show. I appreciate the time.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Don Mann. Go to frogman2ends.com to find out a lot more information on SEAL Team 6 directly from somebody from SEAL Team 6, spent his life there, knows what's going on. You want to talk about realism in a book, you got it in this series, SEAL Team 6, with the latest one called Hunt the Jackal. I recommend getting all four, reading them all, and you want to talk about entertainment value, you got it right there, right in front of you. So we are going to take a short break, and while we get with our next guest here, author MJ Rose, she is, again, the author of the book called The Collector of Dying Breaths. Her last book, Seduction, was the Crimson Scribe Award winner, which is the best book of 2013 that Suspense Magazine puts out. So we are really excited to be able to talk to her, hear about her latest book, The Collector of Dying Breaths, and MJ. So we will see you guys in a couple minutes.
It's time for a face-off where mystery meets suspense. Join us at the 9th Annual Thriller Fest. Learn from top industry leaders and authors at Craft Fest. Get your story heard by industry professionals at Pitch Fest. Celebrate the new 2014 Thriller Master, Scott Turow, and a list of special guests you'll have to see to believe. July 8th through the 12th at the Grand Hyatt in New York City. The premier conference for thriller enthusiasts, those who read them and those who write them. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
welcome you back, everybody, here after the break to the show. And again, we want to thank author Don Mann for joining us and talking about his book, SEAL Team 6. We are waiting on MJ Rose to come on. Hopefully we didn't get anything crossed here and we got some wires crossed up. But I'm sure that there's something going on, and we'll get her on. If it's not today, I'm sure we will get her on some other time, because we love having MJ on, and she's one of our advisory board members also of the magazine. So what I thought I would do is, in the meantime, there's an episode that we have. It's called, or another show that we have. It's called Stranger Than Fiction. It's hosted by Donald Alan Kirch. Instead of sitting here and letting me listen for the talking for the next half hour, I would rather you had listened to something else. Now, if MJ comes on the line during the show, we will interrupt it. You can always go back and listen to Stranger Than Fiction here on Suspense Radio. But what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and play the encore version here on of them for episode 6. So again, this is Stranger Than Fiction with Donald Alan Kirch, encore performance. Listen to this.
Person among us who do not owe a world of gratitude toward the men and women who serve in the armed forces. These especially dedicated people risk their lives and their futures in order to preserve our freedom and our way of life. To citizens around the globe, they are symbols of hope and sacrifice, and they should all be respected for their services. However, there are forces in this universe that are more powerful than the beating hearts of these patriots, and indeed more mysterious than some of the evils these brave soldiers have been sworn to defeat. Hello, I am author and paranormal investigator Donald Alan Kirch, and this is Stranger Than Fiction. Be opening up a case file that has about as many theories, plots, and circumstances as there are grains in the sand of a desert. Indeed, this singular case is more responsible for both investigations into the Bermuda Triangle and extraterrestrial contact than any other modern-day case. Ladies and gentlemen, I am referring to the disappearance of Flight 19.
Man, I don't know where I am. My compass is broken. again. And I have no way of returning. The water is white, and the land is broken. Base. Where the hell am I?
Flight 19 was a squadron of five TBM Avenger torpedo bombers that disappeared off the eastern Florida coast on December 5, 1945. It was an absolute puzzle to the United States Navy, one of the greatest manhunts at sea since the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. A PBM Mariner flying boat also mysteriously vanished during the Navy's rescue mission. Altogether, 27 crew members, that includes the 14 airmen and 13 from the rescuing Mariner, were never heard from again. No one could ever figure out why.
Hey, what happened to the rescue plane off our port wing? I thought I saw the bank along with us.
Yes, copy. I've lost visual contact with rescue plane. Over. Need verification that plane is still on our vector. Over. Yes, do you copy last transmission? Over.
The story itself begins at the Naval Air Station at Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The world had just gotten over the horror of the Second World War, and the United States Navy was gearing down to a post-war peacetime force, not too aware of the Cold War era that lay ahead of them. Flight 19 was to be a simple assignment. Called Navigation Problem Number 1, it was supposed to be a combination of bombing and navigational situations that were to take most of their flight day. No one, not the members of the flight team, nor those stationed at the naval base, had the slightest inkling of disaster. After all, Flight 19 was being commanded by a first-rate commanding officer. The flight leader was U.S. Navy Lieutenant Charles Carroll Taylor. Taylor was a well-trained pilot with over 2,500 hours in the air, all on the type of aircraft that he had flown that fateful day. His students, albeit not as experienced as he, had amongst them over 300 hours in the air, 60 flight hours on the Avenger alone. All of the pilots involved knew and had flown within these waters, having completed several training missions successfully. The remaining pilots of Flight 19 were U.S. Marine Captain Edward Joseph Powers, U.S. Marine Captain George William Stivers, U.S. Marine Second Lieutenant Forrest James Gerber, and United States Navy Ensign Joseph Tipton Posey. Each Avenger had been fully inspected, fueled, and had passed with flying colors. All points of safety were double-checked and recorded, with one small exception. All five planes were missing clocks. This last was considered unimportant because the mission itself relied solely upon the pilot's skill to navigate and estimate distance by using actual time. And all the pilots wore their own watches. For some unknown reason, Taylor had tried to request off the flight due to personal reasons. Barring sick pay, the commanding officer of the base could never allow such a group of fighters to leave without an experienced pilot such as Taylor.
So Taylor, what gives? Got a stomach ache or something?
Sir, I can't explain it. I just don't feel up to doing this flight today. There's something wrong with me. I just can't put my finger on it. I respectfully ask the commander that I be taken off this flight.
Look, Taylor, if it were any other day, I would say, okay. But those kids need an experienced pilot to teach them the ropes. I'm sorry. Flight 19 is your baby. Suit up and return to the field.
Yes, sir.
So, regretfully, Taylor agreed to stay on the flight. To this day, no one has a record of what was actually bothering Lieutenant Taylor. Another reason for Taylor's denial for release was due to the fact that a fellow Flight 19 crewman had already been given permission to bump the flight, the limit for a flight crew during the course of a day. Marine Corporal Alan Cosnar had been the fortunate airman not to fly with the cursed squadron. To this day, no one knows, nor is there recorded, a name for the man who replaced him. In any case, Flight 19 had been cleared to leave the naval base at 1345 local time during air and sea conditions recorded as favorable, sea state moderate to rough. The flight was late to depart, taking off at 1410.
I don't want any lost seats, so pay particular attention to your relative position with your wingman. Any problems? Squawk me.
Yes, sir.
Can you get out the bush? All right, cut the chatter.
As planned, Taylor supervised the flight, allowing a pilot trainee to have the role as leader out front. The mission, navigation problem number one, was to involve the squadron into four legs of their flight. In actuality, Flight 19 flew only three of these. After taking off, they all flew on a heading of 091, almost due east for 56 miles until they reached Hen and Chicken Shoals, where low-level bombing maneuvers were practiced. Almost 67 miles after the bombing, the team of planes continued onward in an easterly direction, turning on a course to 346 for another 73 miles. On this course, Flight 19 was to fly over the Grand Bahama Island. The third and fatal leg of the mission turned the group of Avengers on a course of 241, in which they would fly a combined distance of 120 miles, at the end of which they would turn left, returning to the Naval Air Station at Fort Lauderdale. Simple enough. Naval records of the time do suggest that Flight 19's bombing run did go successfully. The reason they know this is because radio conversations recorded notate that a pilot from the group had called in about 1,500 hours requesting permission to drop his last bomb. 40 minutes later, flight instructor Lieutenant Robert F. Fox, leader of another training flight in the area, received an unidentified transmission, presumably from Flight 19.
Pilot Cohen Powers, over. Please repeat. Last transmission, over. Is anyone there? Over.
From Lieutenant Fox's briefing afterwards, a student from Flight 19 had requested from Captain Powers a reading on his compass.
I don't know where we are. We must have gotten lost after that last turn.
Concerned, Fox tried his best to contact the pilots of the air group. Calling Captain Powers, Fox stated,
"This is FT-74, plane or boat calling Powers. Please identify yourself so someone can help you."
There came no response at first. Then, one by one, the pilots of Flight 19 talked amongst themselves, debating whether or not they should respond. Almost losing hope of offering help, Fox received a transmission using the call sign Foxtrot Tango 28. This was from Flight Leader Taylor. Eagerly, Fox did his best to offer assistance.
FT-28, this is FT-74. What is your trouble? Over. Both of my compasses are out, and I'm trying to find Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm over land, but it's broken. I'm sure. I'm in the Keys, but I don't know how far down, and I don't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale.
Fox, following naval regulations, informed NAS that their planes were officially lost and that he was trying to communicate with the flight leader, hoping to aid them back to the base. Fox indicated that he suggested to Taylor that he put the sun to his port wing and fly north up the coast of Florida. A given time, Fort Lauderdale would be in their sight. Fort Lauderdale had instructed Fox to inquire if the planes on Flight 19 were equipped with IFF transmitters. This was so that the ground forces could triangulate the flight, discovering their true position, and thereby talking them back home. Later, Taylor would offhand admit that his transmitter was activated. Taylor seemed to do everything wrong. At 1645, he transmitted,
"We are heading 030 degrees for 45 minutes. Then we will fly north to make sure we are not over the Gulf of Mexico."
Taylor was immediately ordered to transfer his broadcast to 4805 kilocycles. He never followed those orders. Later, NAS asked him to transfer to 3000 kilocycles. Taylor replied,
"I cannot switch my frequencies. I must keep my planes intact."
At 1646, there were slight clues that confidence in the flight leader by the other Flight 19 pilots was starting to break down.
"Change course to 090 degrees for 10 minutes.
Excuse me, sir. If we could just fly west, we would come home. Head west, damn it."
Regardless of their questioning of authority, Flight 19 stayed together. One would have to ask, why? Flight 19 soon had other factors to consider: fuel and the weather. NAS had estimated, as the weather conditions began to worsen, that the unfortunate group of planes was more than 200 miles east of the Florida Peninsula. It was at this time, while trying to gather up enough of the rescue forces to help aid Flight 19, that the equally unlucky PBM-5 aircraft had been called out to help them. After transmitting only once, the Mariner aircraft was never heard from again.
"We'll fly 270 degrees west until landfall or running out of gas."
Taylor requested a weather check. Land-based radars had triangulated Flight 19, the only time that it had, around a 100-mile radius of 29 degrees north and 79 degrees west. Flight 19 was nowhere near Florida, but north of the Bahamas, well off the coast. Amazingly, no one had thought to transmit this vital information to Taylor. At 1804, NAS received some of the last transmissions from the doomed group of Avengers.
"Holding 270, we didn't fly far enough through. We may as well just turn around and fly east again."
The weather got worse. The radio operators listened.
"All planes, close up tight. We'll have to ditch unless landfall. When the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together."
A British flag tanker, the SS Empire Viscount, had reported that she was heading into heavy seas and high winds northeast of the Bahamas at or around 1804, right within the estimated spot of Flight 19's disappearance. There is one more transmission, said to have come from an independent ham radio operator. Yet another naval aviator had tried to help Taylor hours after his last transmission. When requesting Flight 19's position so that the pilot could join them, Taylor issued a stern warning.
"Do not, I repeat, do not engage. They appear to be from outer space."
This last transmission, however, cannot be confirmed by the United States Navy. After an extensive military investigation involving the largest land and sea rescue team ever assembled off the coast of Florida, all the Navy could say was,
we are not able to even make a good guess as to what happened. This is one of the strangest cases in naval aviation so far in my career.
Those who were in charge of the investigation of Flight 19 kept coming back to two haunting words: pilot error. Taylor had been known as a naval aviator who flew by the seat of his pants. Many times he had been reprimanded for not following proper safety protocols and procedures. Others theorized that Flight 19 had become the unfortunate victim of an Einstein-Rosen bridge and perhaps flew into another dimension. In any case, after the naval investigation, this official explanation was given to the public. Had Flight 19 actually been where Taylor believed it to be, landfall with the Florida coastline would have been reached in a matter of 10 to 20 minutes or less, depending on how far down they were. However, a later reconstruction of the incident showed that the islands visible to Taylor were probably the Bahamas, well northeast of the Keys, and that Flight 19 was actually where it should have been. The Board of Investigation found that because of his belief that he was on a base course toward Florida, Taylor actually guided the flight further northeast and out to sea. Further, it was general knowledge to NAS Fort Lauderdale that if a pilot ever became lost in the area, to fly a heading of 270 west, or in evening hours toward the sunset if the compass had failed. By the time the flight actually turned west, they were likely so far out to sea that they had already passed their aircraft's fuel endurance. This factor, combined with bad weather and the ditching characteristics of the Avenger, meant that there was little hope of rescue, even if they had managed to stay afloat. It is possible that Taylor overshot their course and instead reached another island mass south. He fully expected to find the Grand Bahama Island laying in front of him as planned. Instead, he eventually saw a landmass to his right side. Believing that this landmass to his right was the Grand Bahama Island and his compass was malfunctioning, he set a course to what he thought was southwest to head straight back to Fort Lauderdale. However, in reality, this changed his course further northwest toward open ocean. To further add to his confusion, he encountered a series of islands north of where he was, which looked very similar to the Key West Islands. But he was still over ocean instead of over Fort Lauderdale. The control tower then suggested that Taylor's team should fly west, which would have taken them to the landmass of Florida eventually. Taylor headed for what he thought was west, but in reality was northwest, almost parallel to Florida. After trying that for a while and no land in sight, Taylor decided that it was impossible for them to fly so far west and not reach Florida. He believed that he might have been near the Key West Islands. What followed was a series of serious confusions between Taylor, his team, and the control tower. Taylor was not sure whether he was near Bahama or Key West, and he was not sure which direction was which due to his compass malfunction. Some of his teammates believed that their compasses were working. When that failed, Taylor set a course west according to their compass, which should have taken them to Florida if they were in Bahama. If Taylor stayed this course, he would have reached land before running out of fuel. However, at some point, Taylor decided that he had tried west long enough. He then once again set his course northeast, thinking that they were near Key West after all. Finally, his flight ran out of fuel and may have crashed into the ocean somewhere north of Abaco Island and east of Florida. There is also the Philadelphia experiment connection. During this time, the United States Navy was said to be working on camouflage equipment that would make both aircraft and ships invisible to enemy radar and also to sight. Is it possible that Flight 19 could have been the victim of a secret military operation that was so complex that the pilots and ground control did not understand the equipment that they were using? Could they have switched on a machine and not know how to turn it off? One could chalk up the whole event as a sad case of human error. However, keep in mind, these were highly trained men working within an organization that had been fighting a terrible war for over 4 years. These were not the type of men to just simply get lost. They knew the area and the seas in which they had been practicing in. Then there's that last transmission. Could it have been possible that Flight 19 had been victims of a cat-and-mouse game involving an alien intelligence bent to study the readiness of the world's military. Could there have been forces involved here that we may never understand? Like most people, my first introduction to Flight 19 was probably in the first 5 minutes of the sci-fi classic Close Encounters of the Third Kind, written, directed, and produced by Steven Spielberg. After seeing that scene where those five Navy planes were in the desert, I became curious and I looked into this. I personally believe that they were victims of an intelligence that was far beyond any capable of calling itself even human. One thing is for certain, Flight 19 is still one of the most famous disappearances to yet happen within the waters of the Bermuda Triangle. If you are interested in reading the magazine version of Stranger Than Fiction, please go to suspensemagazine.com and subscribe. If you would like to read my work, go to my website at donaldallenkirch.com. That's Donald Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Kirch, K-I-R-C-H.com. One word. DonaldAllenKirch.com. My books are available in both ebook and print format. It would be an honor to entertain you. So, for Stranger Than Fiction, this is Donald Allen Kirch wishing you unpleasant dreams.
And we want to thank everybody again for listening here again to Stranger Than Fiction. That's an encore performance of Flight 19, which you can listen to all Stranger Than Fictions here on Suspense Radio. Again, MJ Rose was not able to make it all. We will reschedule that. But we're going to have Mike Bond coming on here in just a second. So while we get all that together, we're going to make you listen to a little bit of music. Hold on. So again, everybody, welcome back here to the show. We are pleased that you are here to join us, and we are going to jump right in here to our next guest. His name is author Mike Bond. You can go to MikeBondBooks.com for more information. Mike is a great action-adventure writer, and he has a theme that is a little bit different than something that you might have read before, which is a great background that he comes from. So we want to welcome Mike to the show. Mike, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John, and it's an honor to be on the show. I'm delighted. It's a great show and a lot of good things to talk about.
Yes, we do. We have a lot of good things to talk about. So let's jump right in here to your latest book.
which is Saving Paradise, one of the four books which you have written, kind of like we talked about in this theme. It's a series, but not a series of characters. It's a series of theme, kind of how you have this going on. So give us a little bit about Saving Paradise and, you know, your background in the books in general, going with La Savannah, House of Jaguar, and so on.
Okay, that would be great. Well, Saving Paradise is built, like most of my books, on a lot of actual experience. It concerns the protagonist, a hero, is a former Special Forces veteran from Afghanistan and Iraq, who is also a well-known surfer and is in, because he's Hawaiian, and so he wades out into the water one morning and bumps into the body of a beautiful young woman, and that is how the story starts, and it becomes his passion to find out what happened to her, why she drowned. She was a journalist. She was investigating some very nasty stuff. And in the process of this, John, like in so many of my books, the protagonist starts out trying to right a wrong, and in the end, he ends up being hunted and blamed for her death. And so what I try to do in all my books, and again with Saving Paradise, was I try to put the reader so deeply into the action that the book isn't something you're reading, that this is a real experience and it's happening to you. What also is the theme of Saving Paradise is the island of Molokai, which is one of the five big islands in Hawaii and is rated by National Geographic as the sixth most beautiful island in the world. And the plan is a bunch of huge energy companies and politicians want to cover it with windmills, these 52-story howling monsters that, of course, don't produce any electricity. They just make billions of dollars for investment bankers and energy companies. So he gets tangled up in that as well, which is a real ongoing problem in Hawaii. And it just makes what people say is that they, when they pick it up, they just can't put it down. And that's very exciting to me, because that's why I write. I want to put the reader so completely, as I said, in an experience that it's not something you're reading, it's something that's really happening to you. So that, in a nutshell, I would say, John, is kind of what drove me or got me into Saving Paradise, and the response, of course, has been overwhelming.
Now, because you write with, you know, with the theme, and, you know, you talked about, you know, poachers and things that you had done, like within the Lost Savannah, and, you know, beautiful picture of a lion, by the way. Looks so pretty, like you just want to pet her, and, you know, she's just going to lick you and have fun. But, you know, she's not going to have it. But, you know, you set your, like I said, so it's a great theme, because it's something that I don't think a lot of people quite so understand about, you know, poaching, you know, about, you know, killing elephants for their ivory, doing the same things, you know, with the blood diamonds. We only hear very little snippets of things that happen over there. So with your experiences that you were able to go after these, you know, these people doing these things illegally and, quite frankly, immoral, give us, you know, that kind of insight into you and yourself, which is also part of your books.
Yeah, that's a really good question, John. And what you're referring to in The Last Savannah is my own background in working in military operations against the poachers, ivory poachers in East Africa. And that became the basis for what is an astonishing manhunt, and also a deep love story, which is The Last Savannah. But what I try to do, too, like in my book Saving Paradise, I wasn't just talking about saving the little bit of the natural world that remains, though that's very important. It's connected to saving the paradise inside ourselves, which is our individual freedom, our individual liberty, that which makes our lives exciting and which we spend so little time focusing on, and we need to spend more. So it's what I'm, again, trying to do is to create a profound emotional experience for the reader, and that's why I call my books a literature of liberation, because I think that's what a thriller can do. We're talking here about suspense and thrillers, and in your definition of suspense in the magazine is like the best one out there. The idea that life is suspenseful, and we we learn so much from being in suspenseful situations, like a book can put us into. So I guess I'm saying that's what drives me too. It drives me as well to create something that is literally unforgettable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I always tell people, and they say, "Oh, I don't know if my book is suspenseful." And I go, "All suspense is you're having some kind of anxiety that the reader is going to experience, and maybe you're going to let them off the hook, or maybe you're not." I mean, heck, I always say even American Idol is suspenseful. You don't know who's going home and who's not, so you're sitting on the edge of your seat. And so that's the thing. And the one thing that I love is when you're putting your passion and your flavor and your emotions into this book. So when people pick up any of the ones, House of Jaguar, Tiberian Cross, Holy War, Saving Paradise, all the books you wrote, they're going to understand that they got that sense of realism, not only within your characters, but within the story itself. And it's not going to turn into CSI, which is so unreal.
Exactly. Yeah, one thing I can promise all my readers is that everything that I talk about is absolutely real. When I talk about most, for instance, in my Death Squad military dictatorship Latin American thriller House of Jaguar, I've been to all those places. When I describe a firefight, I've been in the middle of something similar to it. When I talk about hunting the poachers in Kenya and La Savannah, I've been there. I've been out on that. I've done, I don't know, at least 10,000 kilometers of the jungle and deserts and mountains of East Africa on foot. You know, I mean, so this, you're getting the real deal. You're not getting something made up like CSI. This is something real and really has happened and can happen. And you, the reader, I'm giving you the option or the possibility to be right there in the middle of it. And of course, that's why reviewers say that whatever book it is, I've had this said about numerous books of mine, that the book will change you. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to use the thriller genre to reach out and make change in the world.
And since your books aren't really a series, do you have one that when people come up to you and just finding you out for the first time, that you say, you know what, maybe you want to start with this one first and then kind of move on? Do you kind of have an order yourself that you would maybe prefer readers jump into the books?
No, except the book that you brought up first on the show, John, Saving Paradise, is going to be followed. The character there, Pono Hawkins, whom I said is the Special Forces surfer who also has done two jail terms for things he was not guilty of. He's going to be an ongoing character in a number of books, and where he, against overwhelming odds, tries to rectify an evil in the world. And I think that's what we all try to do in our own way, is we try to make a better world every day. And this guy is going at it full time despite great danger. So, yes, that is going to be a series. But as far as the other books out there, Holy War, as I mentioned, is based on my experiences in Middle East wars, and it's a real thriller. House of Jaguar, as I said, is the Latin American one. They're all thrillers, and they're all exciting. What happens is it almost doesn't matter which book a person starts with. They immediately go back and get the rest. And there's more coming. I have four more books that will come out within the next 12 to 18 months.
Also, yes, so you're going to be busy boy then, aren't you?
I am so busy, but I love it. I love it. I spent a lot of my life in third world dangerous places where you don't have time to sit down and write. And now I'm out of that, and I have time to sit down and write and talk about all of the things that happened and all the things that are likely to happen, our situation in Ukraine and Russia right now. I've got a book that I'm going to write on that. It's about third written already. So I try to tie my books into real exciting things that are happening in the real world, and I base them in real places, and I make my people are real. The whole thing is real. I think you can't really get excited. It's not suspense if the reader doesn't somehow think it's real.
And you know what? And I'm glad you picked House of Jaguar, because that's probably one of the parts of the world that I guess I find the most fascinating, because it's in the jungles, and you always hear you know, the jungle has a thousand ways to kill you. Do you have any kind of specific, I guess, you know, story that you can kind of tell about the jungle? Because I do. I find this part of the world in South America, Latin America, the most fascinating to me.
Yeah, I can tell you something that actually happened to me and which ends up in the book, House of Jaguar. One time in the Guatemalan jungle, I was completely lost and was injured. I really was in bad shape, and I needed two things. I needed water, and I needed to get to human habitation. And it was a very, very wearing, exhausting, and when you don't know if you're going to survive, it puts a whole other thing on your head. You change in your head. So anyway, every time I would stop, the ants would start to work on my injury. You know, they'd climb up right on you off the ground. And there's snakes everywhere and stuff like that. So I'm pushing my way downhill because I know that'll eventually take me to a river. And I look, and there's a black jaguar sitting there watching me about 20 feet away. And it's about the size of a leopard, you know. I mean, they're all kind of related. And it was the most amazing feeling because it could have killed me in 10 seconds. And it watched me for a while, and then it turned and started walking downhill ahead of me. And I didn't understand what was going on. So I stayed there. So it came back and looked up, looked at me and turned and went downhill again. It did this like three times before I finally realized it wanted me to follow it. And it led me downhill eventually to a stream, so I got water. And then from there I was able to kill a turtle to eat and move down to the river. So that's the kind of thing that happens in jungles. It's life is so intense in a jungle. There's so much life that it just is overwhelming and very scary. And everything kills, and you're either kill or be killed very quickly, constantly in the jungle. So that's one experience
wow.
I can kind of point to.
That's amazing. I mean, just out of the clear blue. I mean, it was almost like it was sent for you, and to just be, you know, follow me.
Yeah.
I know where you're going. Come on.
Yeah, get out of my bloody jungle already. You know.
yeah. Get your drink and get the hell out. All right, I had enough for you.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, so that was, and I've had a similar thing happen in Africa in the savannah, too. It's a very inspiring thing. This was with a lion, and very, very inspiring. Lions can either kind of almost befriend you, or they can, with a swipe of their paw, they can behead you. I mean, they're so strong. If they swipe their paw, they actually can knock your head right off. But, I'm now working on finishing up a book called Tibetan Cross, where it involves the same thing with animals in Tibet and Nepal. There's a lot of exciting stuff out there, and the real world is so exciting and suspenseful that I think the mistake we sometimes make is to spend too much of our time in kind of boring pastimes, watching useless television or, you know, doing other things, when every minute of life is precious, and I think it's really important to live as deeply as we can as much of the time. And again, that's what I try to urge my readers to do.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. I mean, you just never know. You might as well just, you know, you just live like every second, every minute. You just never know if it's your last. And that's the way that you should, live. And we shouldn't focus on, you know, so many of these negative, bad things all the time, because all that's going to do is just put people into a spiral anyway.
That's a good point.
Bad mood. Yeah, it just makes you into a bad mood. But I just want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author Mike Bond. Go to MikeBondBooks.com for a lot more information. Now, you know, before time gets away from us here, I just want to say, I want you to talk a little bit about a project that you have on your website called the Saving Paradise Project. And, of course, the headline is Maine at Risk. What are you doing there, and maybe how can people get involved with what you're doing?
That's really good. That's a really good question, John. What the situation is in Maine, and it refers again to these industrial wind projects, which in it, my own, I've got a pretty strong background in renewable energy, worked on Al Gore's campaign at a high level, did a lot of work in renewable energy with a whole bunch of people. And so I've learned, as many people, environmentalists now know, that these hideous wind projects that are popping up everywhere, they don't actually have any benefit in terms of climate change whatsoever. They don't really generate, by the end of the day, much electricity. They have enormous negative impacts, and it's just a scam that's fomented by the energy companies and politicians. And it's particularly bad in Maine because the politicians got together and wrote a bill saying that there was no need to do environmental or economic or social analyses of wind projects. So they're springing up all over Maine. They're destroying communities. They're destroying the tourism. They're killing the birds and bats. And so that's what the situation with Saving Paradise Project is about. I use a lot of the revenues that I gain from my books. In fact, almost all of the net author revenues go to a Saving Paradise Project. And the idea is to fund some of these battles, which are so lopsided. Like, I'm funding the battles to protect Maine from wind projects, and I'm funding protection of elephants in Africa, for instance. John, is a way to channel the revenue from my books to really important causes, and human rights in Latin America is another one.
Yeah, so, I think it's fascinating. I mean, just to know, I mean, all the wind turbines and things that we have out here in Palm Springs area in Southern California, you drive through it, it's just a massive amount all over the place of these wind turbines. You don't know what their effect is. You just have no idea.
They don't do a thing. The reason is that wind is so erratic going up and down that you have to run a fossil fuel plant full-time to back up wind projects. And they've done numerous studies around the world and found that this is so onerous that, in fact, wind projects actually add to fossil fuel use and greenhouse emanations. There are 13,000 wind turbines in California, and they take up hundreds of thousands of acres. They kill millions of birds and bats, and they can be replaced by one small gas-fired power plant that would produce like 1% of the greenhouse emanations of all of these wind projects. But the thing is, the wind projects are funded by the politicians, and they're paid for by our taxes, i.e. by our national debt. And it's just a question where the politicians make so much money from the wind producers that they keep it going. Well, this is another frequent theme in my books too, John, is that government, and not just the U.S. government, but particularly U.S. government right now, with all of the political contributions coming from corporations, our government no longer in any way represents the people of America, is the conclusion I've come to. So I try to bring that out
in my book. 20 years.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm a little – I'm a slow learner, John. Excuse me.
I mean, everybody would like to think that our government cares about its citizens, but instead it just uses our citizens like a commodity where it can use us to just try to make more money off of us, because it doesn't do anything to help us. I mean, the little breadcrumbs they throw out there, they say that they're helping. See, look what we're doing. Look what we're doing. Yeah, and now they're going to spend $7 billion on 23 new Marine One helicopters. I mean, how much sense does that make? Some massive politician just made his friend extremely rich with his company. It's like, it's okay.
Well, everybody who enters the House of Representatives and the Senate is a multimillionaire by the time they leave. And like in Maine, the politicians that wrote those bills saying you cannot, you don't need to do any environmental studies of wind projects, one of them went on to build wind projects in Maine and made millions of dollars and used those millions of dollars to buy himself a seat in the U.S. Senate. And he's now in the U.S. Senate. Angus King is his name. And he parachuted his son into a high position in the biggest wind developer in Maine. And here's the son now is a CEO of some division of something. And it's just millions and millions of dollars.
You want to take these names like Angus King, put them in the last Savannah, and for some reason, just some lion just ripped his head off. Hey, it happened. You know, just a bug.
Oh,
don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So,
well, this is why I write. I write to convey all these things to our readers, so we keep that, these things in focus, and that's how we can change our country. If we get so ticked off, we say, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. And that's what my hero, Pono Hawkins, in Saving Paradise is all about. You know, he says at the end, the government has become the enemy of the people. And he started out as a liberal Democrat, you know, and...
Yeah.
So I think that's the direct. I'm just trying to pass the word on to everybody who reads my book is my friend, and I'm trying to share my experience with all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I always find it funny because I always tell people, and I said the one profession that people hate the most are lawyers. No one likes a lawyer, but you know what's funny? That's all we keep electing into Congress, so we wonder why it's so screwed up. It's like people wake up, come on. So and that always cracks me up. It's like you hate them, but you can't stop voting them in. It's like
pretty tragic.
Well, you know, I do have a question. I was wondering though, why did you not decide to just write character series within these, and instead of having them all just standalones?
The reason why is that each of my novels represents a deep emotional period in my life, and. Like Holy War, I was in the Battle of Beirut, and it was a long and terrifying experience. Every day, you talk about not knowing if you never knew if in the next second you were going to get blown up by a car bomb or shot by a sniper. And so it was I couldn't really fit it into a series. It was too unique. The place was too unique. So I write, and I try to write for everybody. So I try to imagine my protagonist. As my reader might be, and so it just makes it tough to put it all in one series. I'm going to continue to write standalones and continue to write my Pono Hawkins series, such as Saving Paradise. But I'm kind of doing both. I got a big book on Iraq and Afghanistan coming out soon, and another book on the '60s. I'm just turning them out. I just in each one is intense and different, I guess, John.
Are you going to any events, VoucherCon, Thriller Fest, anything like that, where fans might be able to like talk and meet and you know shake your hand or anything?
I was going to go to Thriller Fest this year, but it turns out I've got to be overseas. I had to pass on it, and I still have a lot of activity overseas that, and sometimes I don't have a choice as to when I have to go. I go when I'm told. So,
sure.
And as you know, right now, with the Ukraine situation and with the Iranian nuclear bomb, and there's so many other extremely significant things happening right now that it does tend to upset one's schedule a bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you live in real life suspense because you just never know where you're going to go from day to day. So you're just kind of sitting there waiting. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like the real life suspense more than, you know, the same waking up every morning, the same time doing the same thing. So that also gives you that little extra, I guess, insight when you're kind of writing characters and being able to kind of understand their emotions. So I always find that's fascinating. So we got about a minute left. You know, why don't you finish it up? Tell people, you know, whatever you want to kind of finish up and give your and let them know anything else that you have here in the last minute or so.
Well, that's great, John. I wanted to say I'm honored to be on Spence Magazine Radio. It's a marvelous magazine, and so I just want to say to everyone out there that I write for you. I try to share, you know, when I'm risking death somewhere, I bring it back and I try to share it with you, so you can get the benefit of that experience, because that experience can be very beneficial. So. I feel deeply committed to my readers. Anyone who has a question or comment, to go to mikebondbooks.com and just go to contact, and I will get right back to you, as I do. I talk with hundreds of people a week that way. So, I'm honored to be on the show, and I thank you, John, for what you've done, too, to help me to understand that there's a deeper meaning to thrillers than we sometimes give it.
Absolutely, and that's the one thing that we try to help convey. And like always, if there's any other thing that we can do to help you, please always email me, let me know, and we'll do whatever we can, because we're in it for the genre, we're in it for the authors, we're in it for the fans. We want to connect more fans to more great authors that people just couldn't be able to reach before. I mean, that's what we want to see. I mean, that's what we love to be able to see. Get more people to read the genre that we love, and that's what we want to do.
Well, you're doing a fabulous job of it. You're making a huge difference, and we all thank you for that, readers and writers both.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, and it's been such a pleasure to have you on that, of course, we would love to have you back, so keep us up to date, and maybe we'll have you back on before the end of the year when, you know, your next book comes out.
Love to, anytime, and you let me know what I can do for you, and please, again, everybody out there, you want to contact me, just go to my website, and I'll get right back to you. And thanks to all of you everywhere, and let's keep trucking.
All right, Mike, you have a good one. Thanks again so much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Mike Bond, and the latest book is Saving Paradise, along with The Last Savannah, House of Jaguar, Holy War, all themed within kind of the same theme, not sort of a pseudo-series, not really the same characters, but you heard that that's coming here in the future, so you can go to MikeBondBooks.com to find out a lot more information about these outstanding books. We also want to thank Don Mann for being on the show, SEAL Team 6 series. You heard it here that he was responsible for training some of those SEAL Team 6 members that actually fought, hunt, and killed Osama bin Laden. I mean, how fascinating is that? If you don't get goosebumps here by just these two authors on the show, not sure what's going to give you goosebumps. So check that out, usfrogman2ns.com and Don Mann's books. Well, we want to thank everybody again for joining the show. We are sorry that MJ Rose was not able to make it on, but we'll reschedule and we'll have her back on. So again, until then, everybody, visit suspensemagazine.com, see everything that we got going on, going out. Check all the radio shows. Everything's available on demand. You can go to iTunes, download the podcast. Wherever you want to listen, we try to make it as easy as possible. You can always email us here at editor@suspensemagazine.com for more information. And, of course, you can always check out Crime and Science Radio by going to crimeandscienceradio.com. So we'll see you all again in 2 weeks for Suspense Radio. So until then, everybody, enjoy and goodbye. Thanks so much.